Sean Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Trina Ndura, Maria Studio, and Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. This Planned Parenthood fundraiser will screen A Girl Like Her, which tells the hidden history of over a million young women who became pregnant in the 1950s and 60s and were banished to maternity homes to give birth and surrender their babies for adoption. And Jane, an Abortion Service, a documentary of Jane. The Chicago-based women's health group who performed nearly 12,000 safe illegal abortions between 1969 and 1973. There will be a conversation after the films between a former Jane, Judith Arcana, and a girl like her, Lonnie Jo Lee. Again, that's the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the ACLU of Oregon is going to take legal action against ICE on behalf of a Portland man.
The federal government is going to prosecute a friend of the Dayton shooter in connection to the attack.
And in international news, an update on the Hong Kong airport protests.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, August 12th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. On Wednesday, hours after attending a vigil for victims of the El Paso Walmart mass shooting, an armed man, Thomas Bartram, was detained by police outside of a nearby immigrant community center where witnesses said he displayed a knife and threatened people. Bartram arrived to the immigrant community center armed with a handgun and with a banner showing Donald Trump dressed as Rambo. Bartram was later released by police because he had not committed a crime. According to a statement Bartram gave to NBC News, he's planning to attend a demonstration by members of the Proud Boys and other white supremacist groups in downtown Portland on August 17th. Members of Antifa and other left-wing groups say they will hold counter-demonstrations.
Earlier today, Portland police responded to a fatal car crash on Division Street and Southeast 112th Avenue. One of the drivers, a woman, was severely injured and rushed to a local hospital where she later succumbed to her wounds. After investigating the crash site, one person was arrested in connection to the accident. However, the suspect's identity was not released. In 2018, the city saw 34 traffic-related fatalities. Today's tragedy brings Portland's traffic-related death toll to 35 for 2019.
Oregon lawmakers have declared an emergency when passing cuts under a new Senate bill. The changes are being challenged by the Oregon Supreme Court.
Public employees have filed a lawsuit in the state Supreme Court claiming the legislature violated the state constitution when it changed the way retirement benefits are paid. In June, lawmakers passed Senate Bill 1049, which cut benefits to current employees in the public employee retirement system. Lead plaintiff Jennifer James is a school secretary who said she put in 20 years of service and makes $39,000 a year, so these cuts will cost her retirement account $18,000.
HERS was designed to recruit and retain people into public service, which generally pays less than the private sector, and people go into public service for that secure retirement, and 1049 takes it away, breaking a contract.
The public retirement system has an unfunded liability of $26 billion left over from the 2008 market crash. These changes would only address a tiny portion of the amount. Hundreds of thousands of public sector workers pay into their retirement accounts through the system. Specifically, Senate Bill 1049 would take away some contributions that employees make toward an individual retirement account program and remove some of the final average salary calculations. The attorney for the nine plaintiffs, Aruna Masse, called reversing the changes a matter of basic fairness.
A contract is a contract, and these benefits were promised to these individuals. They have provided service under that particular offer of benefits, and they're entitled to receive those benefits.
The bill included a provision allowing challenges to go directly to the state Supreme Court. Employees have won similar cases before Oregon's High Court twice before, clawing back benefits in 2003 and 2008. For KBOU Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Imara Moore.
Attorney General Bill Barr says that the Trump administration will speed up capital punishment against convicted mass murderers next month. Legislation in cases for mass murderers or killings of law enforcement officers will be proposed after Labor Day. Barr told a national gathering today in New Orleans that, quote, punishment must be swift and certain. Donald Trump directed the Justice Department to propose the legislation, and Barr is working with the FBI to develop strategies and measures to address mass shootings and terror attacks. Barr celebrated after reports from earlier this year showed that violent crime was decreasing. He promised to build on the Justice Department's strategies to target illegal guns. He said, quote, in the weeks ahead, we will be doubling down on our attack on violent crime. We will be expanding our efforts against gun violence and violent gangs.
Legal immigrants who use public benefits could have a harder time obtaining a green card or U.S. citizenship because of a policy change by the Trump administration. The new policy will take effect in 2 months. The Trump administration has been trying to limit immigrants who draw on taxpayer benefits. Education, age, English language skills, and wealth are now greater factors in obtaining a green card, also known as legal permanent status. Using Medicaid, food stamps, or housing assistance could all disqualify applicants from receiving green cards or citizenship. This would include around 900,000 immigrants currently living in the U.S. Additionally, the potential for use of these programs will disqualify many more applicants in the future. The policy could reduce family-based legal immigration to the U.S. and make it harder for low-income immigrants to come to the country.
The ACLU of Oregon announced that it plans to take legal action against U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement on behalf of a Portland man who was questioned by ICE agents in 2017. The ICE agents mistook U.S. citizen and longtime Washington County Road Maintenance employee Isidro Andrade Tafoya for a criminal suspect. ACLU spokesperson Sarah Armstrong said the organization will file a claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act, seeking $100,000 for Andrade Tafoya's humiliation, emotional distress, and psychological harm as a result of his encounter with ICE agents. Oregon Live spoke with Andrade Tafoya about that incident.
Targeted, I was stalked, I was singled out, I was discriminated, I humiliated, and left out there hanging after being done wrong to.
Do you have a warrant? Are you with ICE? Do you have a warrant for arrest?
Which?
Do you have any identification? Do you have any identification that you can show them?
Excuse me, ma'am. Please step back.
Who are you? You are not part of the court. We do not know you. Please back away from my husband. Please back away from our car before we call the cops.
Yeah. It's very difficult to even put in words of what before and after. It's insane. It's it shouldn't happen. I never had expected to find myself in this situation because I'm a U.S. citizen. I'd never expected to be the victim. Monday morning, my wife and I were going to a court hearing that she was scheduled to appear to. As we were arriving near the courthouse, we saw a rally of people gathering around. And as we got closer, I realized that it was the ACLU protesters. The lady approached me and asked me, excuse me, could I get your name? And I said, Isidro. And the gentleman yelled, what's your real name? And my wife says, what do you need his name for? Who are you? And then we started asking questions why they want to know who I am, why they want to, do you have ID with you? Can we see your ID? What's your name, your full name? My wife started arguing with the guy. I was arguing with the lady. I was questioning him who they were. Could you tell me who you are? Why do you need my information? And as all that was going on, the lady said, well, I got a picture of you. and this and that. And my wife's like, well, just show me that picture. The picture got in there, my wife saw it, and my wife got outraged because it wasn't me. I saw a gentleman that came on my left side, came towards the lady that I was arguing with the green hoodie, and he goes, can I see the photo? So he took the phone from her, she handed him the phone, he looked at the phone, looked at me, handed the phone back to her, and he tapped her on the shoulder and says, that's not him, let's get out of here. And just like that, it was like, whew, they just all got in their cars and drove off. Nobody said anything. To now, they haven't said anything. I'm sure Oregonian or somebody else is questioning him, and they haven't. I think because they really messed up. The Latinos, Mexicans, illegal aliens, whatever you want to call it, demeaning to me, the way they use those phrases, we're citizens. You name it, we're people. This country is put together of citizens, of different minorities.
That was an interview with Isidro Andrade Tafoya about his encounter with ICE agents, and the ACLU is taking action now.
U.S. immigration officials arrested 680 people in a massive immigration raid. KBOO's Alex Kahn has more on this story.
Arrested 680 people in a massive immigration raid in Mississippi. The raid started in the morning and took place at seven food and chicken processing plants across the state in what's been described as the largest U.S. immigration sting in at least 10 years. 600 agents, several of them armed, were deployed by the U.S. government, demanding to see workers' proof of citizenship. Workers able to confirm their right to legally exist within the borders of the United States were able to leave the scene, but only after allowing ICE agents to search the trunks of their vehicles. Workers unable to provide proper documentation were loaded onto buses and taken to state and military facilities for processing. There is no word yet on what will happen to the almost 700 detained workers and to their families. Some communities have opened up school gyms and cafeterias to temporarily shelter children who have been left without guardians on what was the first day of the school year for many children in Mississippi. If ICE happens to show up at your workplace, you do not have to answer any of their questions, but may direct them to speak with the business's owner. Law enforcement may not enter any area marked as private or employees only without explicit consent or a warrant signed by a judge. For more information on what to do if your workplace is raided, contact the National Immigrant Law Center at www.nilc.org. For KBOO News, I'm Alex Connor.
Ethan Colley, a friend of Dayton, Ohio mass murderer Connor Betts, is accused of giving the shooter body armor, a gun accessory, and a 100-round magazine used during the attack. After the attack on August 4th, the FBI visited Colley's home. Colley told agents he bought the gun accessories for Betts earlier in the year. Agents interviewed Colley again at his workplace. Colley said he used hard drugs with Betts many times. However, when he obtained the gun, Colley checked no when asked if he was a user of any illegal substances. U.S. Attorney Benjamin Glassman said that Colley did not intentionally help Betts plan the Dayton shooting, but Colley told agents about 10 weeks before the shooting, he did help Betts assemble the AR-15 he used in those attacks. About 6 to 8 weeks ago, Betts took the other weapons and accessories from Colley's apartment. Colley was arrested Friday and is being held in the Montgomery County Jail, charged with possession of a firearm by someone who illegally uses a controlled substance and with making false statements with respect to information required by firearms code. He will have a detention hearing Wednesday and faces up to 15 years in prison.
In Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a law on Friday that ensures LGBTQ history is taught in public schools. It was introduced by Representative Anna Moeller to make for a more inclusive curriculum. Equality Illinois, the state's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization, supported the bill and said the curriculum can have a positive effect on students' self-image and make their peers more accepting. The topics that are added include the Society for Human Rights, the first gay rights organization, and the first U.S. woman in space. It's scheduled to go into effect in July 2020.
As you may have heard, Jeffrey Epstein died in his cell at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City last Saturday. The financier and convicted sex offender's death has been unofficially ruled a suicide, though conclusive results following an autopsy have not yet been released. Epstein was 66, and he was alone in his cell only 11 days after being taken off suicide watch. Inconsistencies with the federal jail's protocol surrounding his death are likely to be the focus of inquiries by the Justice Department and the FBI. Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Barbara Sampson announced Sunday that her office had conducted an autopsy of Epstein, though declined to release information that determines the cause of death. Mr. Epstein's death has unleashed a wave of unfounded conspiracy theories suggesting he was killed to keep him from incriminating others. The wealthy financier's alleged friends and colleagues include President Trump, Bill Clinton, England's Prince Andrew, and former U.S. Senator George Mitchell. Attorney General William Barr will continue pursuing Epstein's case and the pursuit and trial of any co-conspirators.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report from Latin Wave Media with host Sylvia Richardson. At 6 after the news, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, we'll hear Prison Pipeline. Adam Carpinelli interviews Kazi Tour, a former political prisoner and member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoner Amnesty. Then at 7, tune into Hard Knock Radio for in-depth interviews and profiles with elected officials, community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians. Tonight's weather will have partly cloudy skies with a low of 60. Tuesday will be mostly sunny with a high of 87 and temperatures cooling off towards the evening with a low of 62. Today in history, in 1969, British troops were deployed in Northern Ireland after riots erupted in Derry and Belfast, known as the Troubles. This British occupation of Northern Ireland lasted until 2007 and is one of the longest continuous deployments in British military history. The quote of the day is from Irish poet W.B. Yeats, who said, "I think it better that in times like these, a poet's mouth be silent, for in truth, we have no gift to set a statesman right."
So, are you a coffee drinker? If so, you might be interested to hear that Harvard researchers are reporting that drinking an extra cup of coffee or any caffeinated beverage increases the chances of a migraine. They suggest limiting yourself to 2 servings per day. Researchers conducted that study for women who experienced multiple headaches in a month. About 66% of the participants consumed 1 or 2 caffeinated beverages a day. The participants reported 825 migraines during the 4,000 days of the study. The more caffeinated drinks, the more the risk of a migraine. Dr. Lori Knepper, a Harvard researcher, claims the findings backed up what experts were telling patients for a while. Knepper said, quote, "We certainly counsel our patients to limit their intake of coffee to 8 to 12 ounces per day."
Many dog owners are sharing the dangers of contaminated water after the death of their pets. While some pets died in the same region, toxic algae is found over the U.S. In North Carolina, 3 dogs died after playing in a pond. Another dog died in Georgia as well. They suffered from liver failure by ingesting water contaminated with toxic blue-green algae. Toxic algae produces toxins that can sicken and kill people. The algae's poison affects the liver and brain. They grow in lakes, rivers, coastal areas, backyard pools, and decorative ponds. It looks like foam and is bright blue and green. It also has an odor. An infected dog's symptoms begin to show anywhere from a few minutes after exposure to many days and include seizures, drooling, weakness, and more. Take your pet to the vet immediately if these symptoms are evident. If you spot the algae, leave the area and don't let your dog drink or swim in the water. If the dog has been in the water already, immediately rinse them off with clean, fresh water while wearing gloves. Humans can be harmed as well, and contact may result in mild symptoms.
The Trump administration announced changes in how it enforces the Endangered Species Act, allowing economic factors to be discussed when considering what protections a vulnerable species receives. The Endangered Species Act, implemented in 1973 under President Nixon, protects more than 1,600 species and is credited for saving the grizzly bear, California condor, and the bald eagle from extinction. With this change, conservation groups fear the doors will be opened for new mining, oil, and gas drilling, as well as development on land where protected species live. The new rules also weaken protection for threatened species. That's a term referring to species at risk of becoming endangered, and it makes it easier to remove a species from the endangered species list. This news has, of course, been met with outrage. Noah Greenwald, the Endangered Species Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, has spoken out. He says, quote, "These changes crash a bulldozer through the Endangered Species Act's life-saving protections for America's most vulnerable wildlife. This revision is set to go into effect 30 days after it appears in the Federal Register, which the New York Times expects to happen sometime this week."
In a national study, the first of its kind, the Greenland Perspective Survey revealed that people on the island are experiencing high levels of anxiety and stress related to the current climate emergency. Effects related to climate change in Greenland, which is close to the Arctic Circle, have been under close scrutiny by scientists, although the effects on the people who live in the area have gone undocumented. In surveys conducted by the University of Copenhagen, the University of Greenland, and the Krax Fond Institute, researchers found that a majority believes climate change has affected and will continue to affect its people, sled dogs, plants, and animals. Warming in Greenland is 2 to 3 times higher than it is elsewhere. Courtney Howard, the president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, told The Guardian, quote, "There's no question that the Arctic people are showing symptoms of anxiety, ecological grief, and post-traumatic stress related to climate change."
Today marks the fourth day of anti-government protest demonstrations at Hong Kong's international airport. 200 flights, both incoming and outgoing, were canceled as thousands of protesters clad in black stormed both terminals this morning in response to police brutality this past weekend. With impending threats of police intervention, many protesters left, while several hundred have stayed. Hundreds of travelers remain landlocked and uncertain amid the chaos. The sit-in began Friday as part of a 10-week period that has seen Hong Kong inundated with pro-democratic demonstrations throughout the city. The unrest started in June, ignited by a bill that could allow China to extradite Hong Kong residents. As of today, that bill has not formally been withdrawn, despite sweeping demonstrations and protests. Hong Kong media has reported that officials are calling the demonstrations radical and bearing signs of terrorism. Hundreds of arrests have currently been made.
An independent organization, the White Counter, reported that more than 50,000 people gathered in central Moscow on Saturday in a rally to demand fair elections. This was the largest demonstration in the city since 2011 and the latest in a string of protests over the summer that have posed the greatest political threat to Russian President Vladimir Putin in recent years. Despite the protests being authorized by the local government, dozens of people were arrested. The Fair Elections movement in Moscow began in early July after the city's election commission rejected multiple opposition candidates' applications to run for a seat on Moscow's city council. The pro-Kremlin United Russia Party currently holds the majority on the city council. The opposition has accused the party of engaging in corrupt schemes that steal city budget funds. Russia's state communications watchdog has asked Google to stop advertising the, quote, "illegal mass events" on its video sharing platform, YouTube.
And we stay in Russia, where last week a failed missile test at an Arctic military facility in Russia resulted in the deaths of 5 atomic scientists. The accident occurred during a test that used isotope power sources. The fuel caught fire and caused an explosion. The incident caused a brief radiation spike, but the levels normalized in less than an hour, and no lasting contamination was detected. The news reached nearby cities, and many residents panicked to buy iodine. Even Norway stepped up radiation monitoring, but failed to find anything abnormal. Today, in a memorial service held for the scientists, the chief executive of Russia's nuclear energy corporation, Rosatom Likachev, said, quote, "The best thing for their memory will be our further work on the new weapons."
The 22-year-old man accused of an attempted terrorist attack at a mosque in Oslo, Norway, appeared in court today. The suspect, Philip Manshaus, is also being charged with attempted murder and the murder of his 17-year-old stepsister. Police say the suspect expressed right-wing white supremacist ideology online, praising the New Zealand mosque attacker who was accused of killing 51 people, along with the mass shooting that took place in El Paso just last week. The suspect opened fire on the mosque on August 10th, injuring one person before being overpowered by 67-year-old Mohammed Rafiq. The attack took place as Muslims around the world celebrate Eid al-Adha over the weekend, one of the most important holidays on the Islamic calendar.
Well, it's been just a month since New Zealand launched its new gun buyback program, and residents in the country have voluntarily surrendered more than 11,000 firearms to authorities. The comprehensive gun reform legislation came just days after an Australian white supremacist killed 51 people after opening fire on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. According to police, more than 1,200 of the weapons handed over were under amnesty, meaning unlicensed gun owners could surrender illicitly obtained guns anonymously and without any questions from authorities.
South Korea is moving Japan off their trusted trade partners list, disrupting the global supply chain for tech companies. South Korean companies exporting to Japan have to complete more documents and allow more time for approvals. The decision was made after some discussions last week. Trade Minister Sung Yeon-mu said Japan downgraded from the trusted status to a new category, citing Tokyo's violations of the basic principles of the international export control regime. The tension between the nations started last month when Tokyo put controls on the exports of three chemical materials to South Korea. The materials are crucial to Samsung and other South Korean companies. South Korea buys about $54 billion worth of Japanese goods, including cars and washing machines. This change will affect the entire global supply.
Some good news out of Africa, where doctors and scientists working in the Democratic Republic of Congo have found a cure for the Ebola virus. The two new treatments have been administered to patients during the recent outbreak in Congo and have shown a 90% survival rate when patients are able to begin treatment within 4 days of contracting the virus. Until now, Ebola has been deemed incurable by doctors. Previous treatments were only able to save about 30% of the people infected with the deadly flu-like virus. From now on, we will no longer say that Ebola is incurable. That is according to Professor Jean-Jacques Muyembe, who has helped oversee the treatments. He goes on to say these advances will help save thousands of lives.
Ash Dykes, a 28-year-old from Old Colwyn in North Wales, finished a year-long trek today. Dykes is the first documented person to complete an individual 4,000-mile journey along the length of the Yangtze River in China. Dykes endured blizzards with bone-numbing temperatures, as well as elevations surpassing 16,000 feet. He encountered slight delays due to Typhoon Lakima. The journey took years to plan, according to Dykes. His trek began at the source of the river on the Tibetan Plateau and was completed near Shanghai today. The Yangtze is the world's third longest river behind the Nile and the Amazon, and the longest to flow through a single country. Media fanfare has flanked the trip with involvement in photo shoots from Adidas GQ and martial arts actor Jet Li. His book chronicling the trip will be translated into Mandarin, with other translations expected to follow. Dykes told BBC News, "I wasn't expecting this. It was just blown up." Dykes' initial travel team bailed out early when the threat of attacks from wolves and bears seemed evident, but he continued on his own.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 12, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Imara Moore, Jeffrey Wade, and Kenzie Beard. Our producer is Tammy Habteas, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland, KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
I'm Ken Jones.
And stay tuned. We have an in-depth news report from Latin Waves coming up next. Have a good night, everyone.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on our in-depth Latin Waves report, host Sylvia Richardson interviews Dr. Wayne Roberts on how traditional customs around food can bridge division in our society.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The thing about food that I find most inspiring is it provides a basis for individual action, for neighborhood action, and for government action. And if the government doesn't participate, we can still do something significant while we're working for that.
That's the voice of author and educator Wayne Roberts. On this week's show, we speak to Wayne about how food can be used as a tool to bring communities together in these times of political difference, and how food can be used to create a sense of oneness. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Wayne Roberts. Wayne Roberts is known for his university teaching, media, labor education, industrial relations, and union administration. He is a Canadian food policy analyst and writer. We're very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. Thank you for doing your program.
Now, you have written a book titled Food for City Building, A Guide for Planners. How does food not only inspire, but can guide our way we plan cities?
Well, I became a food enthusiast late in my life, actually, in the 1990s when I was in my 50s. I started my job as a manager of the Toronto Food Policy Council in 1955. And I'm a pretty good proof, if you need it, that you don't necessarily land in the job you're meant to do when you're in your 20s and 30s. It may take quite a while, but it's worth the wait. And so I was trying to figure out how to make food a city issue. To my mind, if you think of how Indigenous people think of food, or how anybody who really understands food thinks about it, it is an all-embracing issue, what some people call a whole-of-government, whole-of-society issue. And governments find it impossible, therefore, to get food. They, you know, what department do you belong in? Is it in public health, or is it in economics, or is it in, you know, garbage, or is it in transportation? And so the biggest problem I had was saying, well, you know what, it isn't in any of them, it's in all of them. And finally, I came across this understanding through an experience I had that food is not an issue in and of itself, only it is a lever. If cities use food properly and treat food properly, it is not just about food or not just about food and health. It can be about how we can advance reconciliation with Aboriginal people, because they have actually a very profound understanding of food, and they have food needs that a city can help address. It can help advance multiculturalism on a very broad front. It can help create good jobs especially for young people, for starter jobs. It can provide good jobs for newcomers to the city. It can, in my opinion, even solve traffic problems by promoting local food and reducing the number of trucks and cars that are on the road mainly hauling food. So I developed that concept of that food was a way of building the city, therefore something that first of all belonged in the city, and secondly belonged in all departments within the city.
Now, for many of our people, I'm of my ancestry, and we are raised with food as something that's sacred. We have food at our ceremonies, you know, food is part of rituals. Food informs who we are. There are many stories about, you know, being the people of, you know, of corn, right? Being this, how our the seedling that is our life has, you know, so much interconnection to everything we do and how we see affects, you know, what we do in the world. So let's talk a little bit about this idea of wholeness, this idea of whole of government then. How can a government not only see that food, you know, not only connects people, I mean, it helps us understand each other, but also how it can inform the way we understand cities as a living organism?
Sure. Well, that's a great issue. We could go on for a couple of days on that one. But to start with, wholeness is something that is alien to Western thinking. I would say it is native to indigenous thinking and peasant thinking globally. That is the way you describe it, that food has been part of everything from your rituals to a way to fill your tummy, to a way to be healthy, to a way to be spiritual, to a way to celebrate your connection to nature and all of that. And that became the quote-unquote Western or Anglo-Saxon way of thinking about food, I would say around the 1700s, around the time that England and other European powers saw North America and settled it and saw the rest of the world and conquered it and conquered North America as well. But they displaced that view of wholeness with their segmented understanding. And for them, the North American continent, Canada in particular, was about getting cheap corn into the mouths of cheap workers in the Industrial Revolution in England. And that's the one way they valued food, as a commodity in economics, in other words. And so that is one aspect of food. Of course, it's essential for survival, and you can trade or exchange it. And every group of people have done that since the beginning of time. But the idea that that's the only thing that makes food tick is a uniquely Anglo-Saxon concept, and it unfortunately, because of the power of English-speaking governments, especially in the United States and United Kingdom, has spread across the world, and consequently their misunderstanding of what food is has spread across the world with it. And so we're now in a process of an interesting rebuilding of indigenous people, peasant people, and food advocates in Europe who understand there's another way of seeing how we can all configure around the wholeness of food versus the separateness of food.
I was thinking about how, you know, we often hear people talking about the increasing epidemic levels of, you know, diabetes and other illnesses in our society. Mm-hmm. Cancer seems to be constantly alluded to be on the rise. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about the impact that perhaps local gardens, the impact that growing food locally could have, not only on remediating the quality of the food that we eat, but also our ability to, you know, engage in a more holistic way, right? Where our whole body is engaged in producing the food as well as consuming the food, and what benefits that may have for a population.
Great question again. Thank you. Well, I think the reason why urban agriculture is so important, as you mentioned, is not so much because you can produce a heck of a lot of food in the cities. I think about 15% of the world's food is grown in cities now, which is a chunk, but it's not anything close to what cities need. And the world is rapidly urbanizing. The importance of food in cities is not how much food we can create and how much food we can sell. It's how learning about food gives us skills to deal with life in general. One of those skills we need, or one set of them, is about food, nutrition, And I believe that beginning with nursery gardens, which are sponsored in many countries, including Belize in Central America, and many countries in India, they start at a nursery school, kindergarten. Well, the name kindergarten is from the German for child's garden, right? That's what they thought of as the year before grade one, that it should be in a garden. And right through school is you're not only teaching children how to plant food and look out for it, you're also teaching them how to steward something in general. You're also teaching them how to collaborate with one another and to work together as equals. You're also teaching them how to plan in advance, and you can't just put the seed in today and eat tomorrow. It takes months of work. You're teaching them hundreds of habits that are essential, and you're teaching them the uncertainty of life and the need to really cherish and revere what we're able to take, and you're also teaching them the abundance of life. Because the major problem of food is not scarcity, but superabundance. We don't know what to do with all the food we've grown. That is ironically our problem. And so I think that urban agriculture is more a test site for how people can develop new ways of working together so we can take full advantage of the potential of food to transform all our institutions.
What are some of the challenges we face, though? Because here in Vancouver, we have an area that is landlocked. We don't have any more land. We have mountains on one side and the ocean on the other. Mm-hmm. And you see increasingly that agricultural areas are being constantly encroached upon by development. And that doesn't always inspire or create opportunities for children to know even where their food comes from, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, or how to create those spaces. How do we address this issue in ways that can not only ignite the imagination of future generations, but also of the local population who is both striving to create a place to live and a place to thrive?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what, you can't get much better than British Columbia or immediately to your south Washington to try to figure out how to go ahead. It's sort of the ideal scenario because you're close to everything, all the forces of nature, mountain, ocean, you know, cold, hot, and the like. And so, first of all, you're literally at the doorstep of one of the world's great fisheries. And all we need to do, if I could say all in quotes, is to treat this fishery properly, and it can supply the population, certainly of British Columbia, with some of the best tasting and healthiest fish in the world. So you're doing very well fishery-wise. Mountain-wise, that's not either a good place to be growing. There's other things that need to grow there, nor a place that's going to be very productive. But one area where cities are in for some massive increase is, you know, that about 1/6 of the space of all cities is flat roofs. That is the roof of most university buildings, high school and elementary school buildings, most office buildings. That's 1/6 of the space, and that can all be a green roof. And that can all be producing food. And unfortunately, many of our foods are now saturated with parking lots, and we can take over the top layers of the parking lots and install what is now called indoor agriculture. So the air can be purified, and you can grow hydroponically all sorts of food, which as a minor portion of our diet of sprouts and other light fruit and light greens can satisfy a huge portion of sort of the fresh food demand of things that do not last very well beyond 1 or 2 days from when they're picked. Well, you know, when you go to the supermarket and the roof above, they're growing the sprouts that you can buy and eat that night. So there is piles of wasted urban land in every city that's not used, or spaces of which can be used, beginning with, you know, windowsills, balconies, and the like, all of which can support container gardens. So You've got all of that going for you, plus you have some of the best farmland in the continent immediately south of Vancouver, and as well as, you know, immediately east of you. So, and not to mention Vancouver Island. So you got pretty well everything that is needed. And the most interesting question is, why has that not been started in a serious way? Because the food movement in BC is one of the oldest sections of the food movement in the country. Farm folk, city folk, probably one of the first real food organizations in Canada, came out of the Vancouver area and was actually the inspiration for me becoming a food guy. So I think it's really a rife with opportunity kind of situation for any number of reasons.
When I was a child, my father used to plant our milpa, which is a cornfield. And one thing I learned was that everything worked with everything. You know, we planted corn and then we also planted beans, and the two would help each other grow. One, and so this idea of diversity, this idea of interdependence is so alive when I see plants growing, when I go into nature. But I love your idea of bringing nature into our homes. So what would be a small project you could offer our audience that they could get their children started? Something that they could do from their windowsills, from their, you know.
Okay, great idea. Now, here's my understanding of milpa, is that the great contribution of the Mayan people, first to North and South America, where their ideas spread, and secondly to Europe and the rest of the world, is the three crops that were the mainstay of Mayan life, not to mention one of the great, the non-three, like chocolate or cacao and chiclets and a whole bunch of other things that were invented first by indigenous people in Central America, but and the potato, which comes out of South America. They not only develop ways of growing them together, and that is, the corn takes a huge amount of nitrogen in order to grow. The beans that grow up along its stalk add nitrogen, pulling it down from the air. And the squash or pumpkins that grow around it on the ground with their huge leaves protect it from erosion. So that they're known as the three sisters. But milpa is that, I believe, plus it is the foraging for wild greens. There were as many as 45 that were in the daily diet of Mayan peoples, and are in the daily diet of Mayan peoples who follow those practices to this day. And so not all of these are well suited to balconies, like corn is a pretty big stalk, but you could definitely do it if you wanted to just see if it could be done. And you should have one in every classroom so teachers could use them as a model for how life works when you know three's company. You know, it's like the more the merrier, the more diversity is, the better. So there is a good place for that, would be at the front of every classroom. But then you also need to have a park nearby where there's an area for people to forage the wild greens that grow there. And probably we talk a lot about food waste. We waste about half of the food that's produced. But when we talk about food waste, we never talk about the fact that we waste all of the what are called weeds. I refer to weeds as plants with a bad public relations. And most of the weeds in there, most of what are classified as weeds in North America, are actually healthier than most of the things that are sold as foods, you know, beginning with the dandelion. And there's a whole range of them. So you could do foraging in any park. You could have entire meadows that are beautiful places to walk. And while you're walking, you can pick up a few greens, which is the way women usually were gatherers of wood. And as they'd be gathering their wood and going through the forest, they would be picking up bits of greens, and they'd pick up enough in the bag to add to the milpa at night when they got home. That's sort of how it worked, and how women became the founders of both seed savers and of medicine, because they were the ones who found out, this plant does this and this other plant does something different. So there's some really great groups in Vancouver that orient towards young people, And there's other groups like Farm Folk, City Folk that work with older people, I think, mostly. And you could easily concoct some very doable schemes at a household, school, and neighborhood level.
I love your enthusiasm, and I can see that this is a passion project for you. What inspires you, not only that, you know, you can ignite, you know, the imagination of children through food, that you can ignite the imagination of governments, you know, to create a whole society, this idea of wholeness in our communities, that we are all interconnected, that what we do matters, you know, on even, you know, every little thing we do matters, and that mm-hmm. it affects the world. How do you keep yourself nourished and, you know, engaged?
Well, to be honest, it takes a lot of work, especially in today's world. But the thing that food offers, in my opinion, is that it is very much a positive project. That's not to say there aren't big problems that have to be criticized and campaigned against. But overwhelmingly, if you are a positive person, there is more than enough for you to do. You know, with your own gardening or with your own community project, start a garden at your neighborhood school, or if you're at university, there's all sorts of immediate projects. And I think there's a program called Meal Exchange, which is operating at either Simon Fraser at UBC. You can get the local government to be purchasing local and sustainable foods, which is a very doable project and allows large-scale farmers to engage in it. Go to your local farmer's market. So it's hard to be downcast when there's so many positive things you can be doing. And so I don't care to think too much about Trump. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole of losing every day to following the latest crazy tweets he's doing, or any of the other sort of dark populist kinds of things that are dominate the headlines in the world's news. The thing about food that I find most inspiring is it provides a basis for individual action, for neighborhood action, and for government action. And if the government doesn't participate, we can still do something significant while we're working for that. So I guess that's what I find. Somewhere around middle age, I said, I want to stop becoming a better protester and demonstrator in that sense, and become a better demonstrator in terms of demonstration projects. And so that shift in my life is, I guess, been continually nourished by the potential for food.
That's beautiful. You are actually a very good example of how not only can we find the opportunities in the crisis, because we could all focus on, you know, the massive fires and erosion of the earth and things like that, and those things we need to pay attention to. And we also, at the same time, need to find the opportunities to engage, to create, to co-create the world we imagine is possible. Now, you talk about this in one of your conferences that's coming up. You're titling Whole in One, Six Ways Food Can Transform Cities and Institutions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, well, thanks for plugging that. So you've been talking about the holistic view, and that's what got us going, and that's sort of the theme that I'm starting with. And the sub-theme is six ways that food can transform cities and all institutions. And I've done this in collaboration with Tamara Soma, who's a woman from Indonesia originally, who teaches at Simon Fraser in planning. And we've designed, mainly through her inspiration of great teaching techniques, a day's workshop on Friday, September the 20th, from 9:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And I'll give a talk to give a bit of some of the tools to use in thinking about food. And then we're going to pair up with two unlikely people. You'll be paired with somebody who's most fairly much unlike you, and I'll be paired with someone somewhat unlike me. And we'll spend an hour trying to figure out how food can help each of us understand each other better. And then we'll come back and try to see what magic we can weave in a common workshop with that. So I'm really looking forward to this. It's a concept of a learning journey that Tamara has developed, and it's going to be sort of at the center of this day of workshops.
That's wonderful. You know, among the Navajo people, they say that diversity teaches all how to be ourselves, right? So I'm very excited to see that you're coming to Vancouver. I'm very excited to meet you in person, and I look forward to having this, you know, engaging discussion. Now, as we come to the end of our program, what would be some, you know, inspiration you'd like to leave our audience, or tips or advice on how to tend to the garden, things that they should consider that may be seasonable advice? Or
I guess I would say the starting point of problems with food is to just is to see it as a problem. You know, that most often the word most commonly associated with food, if you read put it in Wordle, and is food problem. And so I've sort of campaigned for most of my career against the idea that there's any food problems. We have created the problems. Food has no problems other than those we've created. And so don't see it as a problem. See it as an opportunity, and for whatever purpose, here's a chance to turn breakfast into an opportunity to get to know my younger brother better, or to just be alone in my own thoughts, or to practice a gratitude, which I think is part of what we have to give ourselves a minute or two every day to think about, a theme to sort of start the day with, how I can use food to have more fun with my friends. You know, I met some Chinese graduate students the other day who said the thing they couldn't understand about North American graduate students is that around 10 o'clock at a party, they order in food. So whenever we used to have a party around 10 o'clock, we'd all start cooking food. So in other words, we want to move from the consumer status to the producer and the agent and the owner of the activity. And I believe that it needs to become a sense of your own empowerment and agency and place in the world. So that's another big type of opportunity that can be done in a little way daily, and in a long way over 365 days a year, in a really big way.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today. Your book, Food for City Building, A Guide for Planners. How can people access your book? How can people access your work?
Well, I guess the you could connect with me on LinkedIn, and I host about six discussion sites, one with Tamara Soma on food waste, by the way, on LinkedIn. They're all free, and that's one way, and the other is to look for my book, Food for City Building, on Google, and it's available only electronically, and it's ultra cheap as a consequence. It's like less than $5. So, and it's sort of a memoir of my times and troubles when I manage food issues for the City of Toronto.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Sylvia. It's been a great experience. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at The Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber, and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up is Labor Radio.
Just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Working